Hi, this is Noam Shore, and welcome to the fourth episode of The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast.
I'm Eric Warista.
And this is Noam Shore.
And you're listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast.
So, Eric, it's been a little while since we've last recorded, and a number of games have gone by. Life has been busy as amateur podcasters. And you know, for a while, I was thinking, okay, I'm going to be excited about the next episode because the Revolution are showing some promise. They were winning some games earlier on. Tied for first for the Supporter Shield, best team in MLS. Carlos Heel had been playing as best as I've ever seen him play. Just phenomenal soccer. We have a number of new players that are showing some promise. And all of a sudden, it's all gone wrong within a couple games.
It's really amazing how quickly the tide has turned here. They started the season very strongly, but in the last seven games, just one win. They got bounced from the U.S. Open Cup. They've lost their last three in a row. And it's hard to know where to point the finger or what the problem is. Where would you start now?
Well, certainly with injuries, right? They were playing pretty well, top teams, being able to win on the road, crush some lesser competition at home. And all of a sudden you have Dylan Barrero out for the season, Carlos Heel went out yesterday, which looks like could be a lengthy spell on the bench as he tries to heal. And Gustavo Boe hasn't been with the team for a long time. So you have three of their top three players on the offensive side of the ball anyway. And it's difficult to see how they're going to recover, or it'll take some time to figure out a new sense of team structure as they go along. I think the one statistic last night for me against Philadelphia is that they had zero shots on goal. Zero.
Right, and that'll tie into another problem that the team has had this year, which is scoring goals. But I want to stick with injuries for a minute and just add to your list. Henry Kessler has missed a lot of time with injuries.
That's correct.
Tommy McNamara hasn't played at all this season.
Nacho Heel hasn't played this season.
Nacho Heel hasn't played at all. So this team, which we thought had a lot of depth and does have a lot of depth, is getting tested in that regard right now. Those players who look good on the roster as the 16th, 17th, 18th man on the roster are now being forced into the lineup on a more regular basis. Some of whom are performing well, stepping into those roles, but it's a different situation than we were in just 3-4 weeks ago.
And I think with some of the new players coming in, they've been able to adjust well and be part of a strong team, given just enough continuity with the rest of the roster, in particular, again, Carlos Heel. But when he's not there, then that suddenly changes a lot of the responsibilities for some of the players. And now you have an 18-year-old, Noah Buck, who's effectively playing that center midfield role and trying to orchestrate the offense. And he's certainly really stepping into his shoes as a great player for the Revolution. But it's going to be a tall task, I think, for the team to really find its rhythm as a force in the league, given all the people who are not playing for the team.
Yeah, they've had trouble integrating some of the new players, or the new players haven't maybe performed to the level that we expected just yet. They seem to be on a good track earlier in the season when the team was winning, but in the losses, it really stands out that there haven't been goals.
Right.
You know, the last three games, they've just scored one goal. And in fact, this six game streak where they only have one win, they only have five goals in six games. So that, you know, you're really talking about Bobby Wood and Giacomo Veroni, who have a couple goals this season and got off to a good start, but haven't really been able to find the back of the net lately. And there's been some just sort of bizarre decisions in some of the games around either bizarre decisions or bizarre scenarios where, you know, Noel Buck had really a world-class goal called back last week because a Revolution attacker was offside and blocking the goalie's vision, according to the referee, or actually according to VAR. Initially, they ruled it a goal. So strange plays, strange days. But I think when you look at the Revolution's designated players, they're really, their only designated player right now is would probably be Jordy Petrovic in goal. Everyone else is hurt or still trying to find their role in the team and perform at the level that was expected of them.
Right. And you do have Veroni, who I think we were expecting to play that role of filling Buxa's shoes and has had challenges trying to get synced up with the team and even just starting regularly over Wood. And Altidore has been coming in as a sub. So we do have some big names still with the team, but have, as you've mentioned, struggled to really come together as a unit there.
Right. I mean, let's look at the designated players. I'm just looking at the roster now. So Gustavo Bow has been very solid for the Revs, but he's not on the field very often. Heal is now hurt and has been hurt periodically. And Veroni still trying to get more involved in the game. And that's it. They're not getting out of the designated player slots what they expected at the start of the season. So anyway, the designated players haven't been able to really gel just yet.
Right. And or injured. And here's another example of the impact that Heal is having on the team. And this was almost tragic comedy, and maybe this had an impact on Heal's health in the game yesterday, but against Miami, he was being, and this was a week ago, he was being fouled consistently. And at one point the referee, and this is pointed out by the commentator, so I'll give credit to the Apple commentators on this. They're saying how the referee at one point just pointed to Heal and then pointed to everybody on the Miami team and said, no more fouling. And the next person who's going to foul Heal gets a yellow. And I'm not sure if I've ever seen it so deliberate in that way. Like you can see often the referee, you know, will do a gesture to say, that's it. You know, you can't do any more of these fouls. But just to specifically call out and in advance say, all right, the next foul on Heal is yellow. I don't know if I've seen that before. And sure enough, the next foul on Heal, the yellow came out. And then there was another foul on Heal and another yellow came out. I think Miami had four yellows maybe, and three of them were from fouling Heal. It just shows how much of an impact he has on the game and how teams just know they have to stop him to stop the Revs. And to your point, you know, Buck's goal had stood against Miami. It could have been a very different game there and come out with at least a result, some bad luck. But without the orchestrator on the field, there's going to be a lot of pressure, and especially on the new players. So it's almost like the rest of the season, or at least the summer time, is going to be kind of like a rebuilding phase, and maybe that's something to look forward to see how players step up and start to find their identity, having to really do more of the lifting for the team.
Right, it's a great opportunity for a lot of the younger players. You know, the three players up from the academy squad this year, Panayiotou, Baraktevich, and Buck, are going to have to mature quickly and step into some big shoes. I think the point about Heal is well taken. MLS has always been a very physical league where to call Carlos Heal finesse player is probably a bit unfair, but players that have a bit of skill sometimes are unfairly punished because refs can't give a yellow card on every play or can't call a foul on every play. So the teams that are physical can sometimes be a bit more disruptive. And the Revs didn't necessarily retaliate. And I wonder if they're still missing that enforcer type. And maybe that's Tommy McNamara being out. So mixed into this recent tough stretch for the Revs was a loss in the U.S. Open Cup to Pittsburgh. So the Revs bounced here fairly early in the tournament. Curious, as a
bounced at home at Gillette Stadium.
That's right, at home against a lower division club. So how much do we care about the U.S. Open Cup, especially this year?
That's a good question. I had a note to think about more about what would make the U.S. Open Cup more relevant. Like I've been to games, U.S. Open Cup games before, in particular when they're played at alternate venues. I think I've seen two games at Harvard in the past. And I love the change of pace. You're in a small stadium. It's not even really a stadium at Harvard. I wouldn't consider it that. And there's some bleachers and you're right there on the field. And it's exciting. And it's a different kind of game. And the other team is there. And it has that excitement of the team anywhere in America being able to work their way up and compete against the best teams in the top leagues and see what they can do. And it's not the first time that the Revs have been bounced early on, of course, by a lower division team. I think one of the games at Harvard that happened. So there is something intriguing and exciting, just like the big cups tournaments in Europe and in England in particular. But they certainly is a difficult draw. And it's not clear to me. For me, the U.S. Open Cup gets interesting more in the later stages once you make it through. That's another trophy to win. But early on, it doesn't quite have the cachet that certainly like the Supporter Shield or MLS Cup. It doesn't have the cachet that some of these other cups tournaments have in the U.K.
I think the point about venues is important because it's not appealing to go to Gillette Stadium for a U.S. Open Cup in a midweek,
right,
on a midweek date. And, you know, I think there has to be a way to make it more interesting because the storylines are compelling. I mean, anytime a lower division team takes down an MLS club, especially the earlier you are in the tournament, you know, you have that tremendous underdog dynamic going on. I think as a Revs fan for this year, I was not that excited about the U.S. Open Cup. And the reason being that 2 years ago when they won the Supporters' Shield and then last year's disappointment, this year it felt like, okay, the roster's been retooled. Generally, the team is healthy and they got off to a strong start. So let's prioritize the regular season and the MLS playoffs and try to win that first MLS Cup. And I think you saw that a little bit in the lineups they were fielding at the Open Cup games. You know, usually the first 60, 65 minutes, there would be only one or two starters on the field for the Revs. And then it happened in the previous round. They brought on four or five starters at the 65-minute mark. They were able to pull out a win in the early round, but not against Pittsburgh in the loss that knocked them out. But they did the same thing. So they're really, I think, the way the roster or the lineup was structured on game day in the Open Cup showed that they weren't really prioritizing it either this year.
It's certainly an opportunity for people who aren't getting as much playing time to step up. And I think your point about the venue is well taken, and that might be the formula to make it more interesting is playing these games in smaller places for a different feel. Right. Like who wants to go to a midweek game Wednesday evening at a cavernous Gillette Stadium when there's going to be a small crowd? It's not a draw. But if it's at a college stadium somewhere and it's in town and you get to enjoy, you know, dinner and not have to drive all the way down there, I think that could be interesting.
Yeah, and they could move it around Boston too, right? There's a lot of college stadiums in town that might be a good fit for that. So they have some options there, and as for what to do with the venue.
And it would be a nice way to bring in games to other communities in the Boston area, build some more excitement. Another way for people to go enjoy the game and maybe who don't often get out to Gillette. So I agree with all the college venues. There would be other ways to do this.
What if they played a game in New Hampshire or Maine or Vermont, Connecticut, somewhere else in New England, Rhode Island, maybe? That could be kind of interesting too. I don't know if they have the soccer facility, but
that could be interesting for sure. I guess it's a little bit more travel for the home team in that regard. but it would certainly be interesting to have a game up in Portland. I'd love to go see a game in Portland. That's a good call.
Right. Well, speaking of venues, maybe this is a good chance to shift gears and go to a topic that's somewhat off topic for us, the World Cup, but also a topic that's very close to the core of this podcast, which is the playing surface at Gillette Stadium. And so some big,
that's right,
big news this week out of Bob Kraft saying that he wouldn't be surprised if Gillette Stadium got at least six games so that a grass field would be put down for the World Cup in 2026.
And not just a grass field. They're going to put a, like a permanent grass field for the duration of the World Cup. So they're going to rip out the turf that's there now and plant real grass, like real dirt, not just those bins of grass that they put on top of the turf as a temporary field.
Right. That sod that always coming apart at the seams and doesn't look right. Great. Yeah. So permanent's a funny word because it's a permanent, permanent in this case means for about 8 weeks, I think.
right.
Because Revs executive Brian Pilello was also quoted as saying after the World Cup, they're going to rip it out and put turf back down. So at this point, no need to change the name of our podcast.
Right. Turf will be coming back to Gillette. Well, you know, there's still some rumors of soccer stadiums being bandied about and perhaps Everett, something like that. So by 2026, we still might have an identity crisis, but for at least I'm looking forward to a summer of grass for the Revolution. But actually, now that I think about the scheduling for a more extended World Cup, at least six games, you know, that's a few weeks there. What's going to happen to MLS during that time? I think typically they've played after the first round completes in the past.
That's a great point.
But if there's World Cup games going on, I think the Revolution, I guess they'll be traveling for a while, put it that way.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of questions to be answered, I think. So will MLS shut down for maybe 2 to 4 weeks to let the first round or maybe the first and second round process and play out? You know, will the Revs play there? It's hard to imagine they'd be playing there leading up to the World Cup, because I think they'd want that field to be pristine for the start of the World Cup. And the MLS season starts in February. The World Cup would probably start in June. Oh, and then after the World Cup, you know, would they even get to play on the grass field? Because if the World Cup ends in early July and the Patriots season starts in September, if the Revs were going to play out the season on grass, it would imply that the Patriots are also going to play that season on grass, which I think the Patriots might not mind. I mean, when you see interviews with athletes about turf, they usually talk about increased risk of injury from playing on a turf field. There are some players who feel like they are faster on turf, and so they prefer it for that reason, but the injury risk seems real and is certainly documentable. So, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly after the injury to Dylan Barrera, which I was there to see, and that was just really a sad moment when he went down, and you can see the injury was less of a direct tackle than how he landed trying to avoid a tackle. But I was thinking, you know, if that was grass, would have there been more play and, you know, a little bit softer landing for him there and not have as big an impact on his knee?
Yeah, absolutely. You see it all the time with you know, people get kind of caught in the turf or there's a weird twist of a knee or an ankle. And then the other thing is, you know, with a turf field, you have synthetic material over rubber on top of cement.
Right.
And with a grass field. So just thinking about things like concussions and other things, not that you can't get a concussion on a grass field, but it just seems as though it still seems fairly or unfairly that that turf is less preferable to grass. And I don't know that the Revs would get to finish that season on grass, even if there was a grass field there. So maybe they would be playing in an alternate venue, at least for 2026.
Yeah. Well, here's just a wild thought. I remember going to a Gold Cup game, I think with you and your family, actually, way back. And it was a doubleheader with the Revolution playing and then an international game with the U.S. and I think Costa Rica or El Salvador, actually. What are the chances of having a doubleheader MLS game and a World Cup game? Do you think that could be possible?
Oh, boy. No. My gut reaction is no. I don't think so either. Yeah. Why don't you think so?
It's just, it's never happened. Something like that's never happened. Like any of the other professional leagues, first of all, just don't play during the World Cup. It's only in the U.S., given our summer schedule. And I just think it would be, from a security ticketing perspective, it would be a little bit much. Interrupt the pomp and circumstance of all the World Cup ceremonies that might, you know, happen before a group stage or knockout game.
Right.
But it would be kind of cool just to have, you know, the fans would get an extra game and the home team gets to play in front of a sold out stadium.
It
most likely.
Yeah. It's an interesting idea. I know they did it and they, as you said, they've done it in the past with international friendlies, with club friendlies. I think it's possible they've done it with women's World Cup matches or maybe just women's friendlies, but I think all of that was before a World Cup game was a guaranteed success from a ticketing standpoint. I mean, the 94 World Cup did very well, but it wasn't insanely hard to get tickets. I think this go around, tickets will be much harder to come by at all the venues for more or less all the games. So and partly because it's being shared with Canada and Mexico, so you lose some games that way. Although, as you point out, when we were talking earlier, the number of teams is going up to 48. So maybe the tickets won't be quite so bad, but I think it will be a pretty tough ticket. Okay, well, let's hope the Revs can pull it together here, and some of the young players fulfill their promise a little earlier than expected here as the Revs deal with some injuries.
Yeah, I think an upside, although initial disappointment of a promising supporter shield run probably not happening, but we'll get a chance to see how the new team starts to develop. I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Bruce Arena also, and it'll be a different kind of next few months, I think, for the team, but it could be exciting in ways we haven't thought of. As always, thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.
We thank you for listening to The Last Team on Turf, a New England Revolution fan podcast with Eric Warista and Noam Shore. We hope you enjoyed the show and can't wait to hear from you. The show was hosted, produced, and edited by Eric Warista and Noam Shore, and all opinions expressed are their own. Incidental music written, arranged, and performed by Eric Warista. Rev's crowd clips appear courtesy of the New England Revolution. The Last Team on Turf is a production of Row 12 Media. Everybody!